Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Omar Project. I'm really excited about today's guest, but before we get started, I want to make sure I invite you to join theomarproject.com. That's spelled O-M-A-R, because you can get a lot of great insight on project management, the skills you need to up your game, and also learn from the best project managers in the world on the most complex projects.
Hello and welcome to the Omar Project. Today, I'm really excited because we have John Atkinson. John is the Chief Executive Officer of the Idea Village, and he's got a tremendous amount of experience. So just to give you a couple highlights from his past work, he is a previous consultant to numerous business, a business advisor, a board member. He's done much strategic consulting based on some of his work with entrepreneurs. So he's always been somebody who's been very heavily involved with entrepreneurship through Loyola University Center, where he was the founding director of the Entrepreneurship and Community Development, and also visiting professor for management and entrepreneurship at University of New Orleans. He's a co-founder and fund administrator at Lanyap Angels, LLC. He holds his MBA in strategic management and entrepreneurship from Tulane University. And if he's not doing entrepreneurship, you can find him out in the waters of the Gulf, enjoying the area of New Orleans. John, I want to welcome you to the Omar Project. I'm really excited to have you on the show. This is one of my favorite topics, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about this.
Awesome. Thank you. Hi, Omar. Super excited to be here and to talk about entrepreneurship in New Orleans.
Yeah. So let's get right to it. First thing I want to talk about is what drives you. Your whole career has been focused on basically entrepreneurship. What is that? What drives that? Where did that come from?
So I'm someone who really loves to be in the trenches with folks who are building interesting things as close to the point of inception as possible. So I think what makes me excited to do the work that we do is the opportunity to say, hey, you know, I was there when, and I was able to sort of influence the trajectory of a company, and that company ultimately became successful. And so that is a really unique opportunity in the work that we do. And I think also translates to a lot of opportunity for New Orleans and for our broader community.
Yeah. And New Orleans in particular, I don't know what people outside of New Orleans think, but I know I've been plugged in. I've gone to a lot of Idea Village events, and I know there's a lot of activity in the entrepreneurship space, but where do you see New Orleans fitting in the entrepreneurship, maybe let's say market or spaces that are available? Like we have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different cities that are really moving in this direction, or they're already extremely active. So where do you see us?
Yeah. So New Orleans is a very unique place. It's a place that has this sort of tension between authenticity and innovation that you don't see in the same way in other parts of the world. And I think that unique tension is in a lot of ways what our strength is based on, and an opportunity to sort of get in front of where the puck is going. New Orleans has seen a tremendous pace of change as it relates to entrepreneurship and to startup activity over the last 10 to 15 years, particularly since Hurricane Katrina. I would say we're one of the few places in the country that has meaningfully moved the needle on our sort of attitudes towards risk, our sort of embracing of startups, our approach to innovation. You know, we've created from the ground up a homegrown movement that, you know, just in the last week has announced its first $500 million exit and has another $1 billion company, both who are alumni of the Idea Village, coming behind it. And so we've served over 285 companies through our accelerator over the last 15 years. And that group of folks is really starting to lead a movement around building innovative companies in New Orleans. And I think what's particularly exciting as we look to the next chapter is New Orleans is uniquely positioned to solve some of the innovative problems that are where the innovation frontier is going, right? So if you think about things like industrials, if you think about clean tech, if you think about energy, if you think about even education, health technology, those are things that we have sort of unique perspective into and unique set of experiences around and a depth of talent in a way that places like Silicon Valley and other sort of leading innovation markets don't necessarily see the world in the same way. And so we can be a source of those solutions. And I think we're at this tipping point where we've put the infrastructure in place to be able to build that. And now the wind is sort of coming in our direction.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. Let's start off with the first thing which is the big news recently about Levelset's acquisition for $500 million and how that impacts New Orleans. I remember just being living here, and one of the goals was like, we need to get a unicorn, like $1 billion plus acquisition, because of the how that impacts the entire culture of the city and how that brings in more funds and kind of makes New Orleans something, puts it on the map. You mentioned that, but you also mentioned another company coming behind. Could you talk a little bit about the impact of those two and then how you see that transforming maybe the future New Orleans entrepreneurship scene?
Yeah, so the Levelset acquisition is obviously huge. You know, for one, it proves to ourselves that we can do it, right? So it's a major milestone in terms of inspirational capital, in terms of sort of people believing in this movement, and in terms of it catalyzing that sort of next generation, right? Who looks at this and says, look, this can be done in New Orleans. So that's the first thing. And I think that's really not to be undervalued. The second thing is you now have a group of people that have done this in New Orleans. They've built a company from the ground up. They've made money in that process. That translates to what is effectively a reseeding event where you now start to think about most of those folks who are in their the early to mid part of their career are now going to be looking at what do I want to do next? And that has a major positive influence on the local community, the local ecosystem, and the amount of local activity that's coming here. And then I think the third thing, as I mentioned, it's not an isolated incident. So I think most people were surprised by the announcement of the Levelset acquisition because they've been looking at a company called Lucid in the research technology, res tech space that was started a little bit before Levelset and saying, well, if New Orleans is going to have an exit, it's definitely going to be Lucid. And that sort of not happening is actually a really positive thing, right? So, you know, Lucid is still a very healthy business and we hope probably headed in that direction, but it's not our only horse in that race. And so I think that's really exciting. And I think that just reinforces that momentum coming off of this great news from Levelset.
Yeah. And I think it's also a testament to Idea Village because you're saying, I mean, they've gone through the facilitation and the program that Idea Village has put out. So for the entrepreneurs maybe that are across the country or people that are interested in have, they have great ideas and they're looking for something like what Idea Village offers. Could you provide a little bit more on how you help people coming from the idea phase to connecting them into the latter stuff that goes, goes next?
So Scott Wolf with Levelset's been sort of very generous with talking about what the Idea Village did for him and for what was then called Z-Lean. And he was he went through our accelerator program in 2013. He won our big pitch competition at New Orleans Entrepreneur Week, then called the Culture Pitch, now called Idea Pitch, and really was able to use that as a springboard to facilitate the sort of early connections and the early network that helped him build that company. That was before my time, so I can't directly take credit for that. And this is something that we need to really focus on sort of applauding the team for, but it speaks to the core of what we do, which is to surround companies with the resources that they need to succeed, to network them with each other, and to provide a sort of basic accountability function that helps hold a founding team accountable to their own milestones. It's amazing that you put those sort of simple concepts together and you can get these sort of really powerful results. And so we look at ourselves as a sort of institutional holder of that knowledge about how to build a startup business and a connector of the network of people that have done it, that we're sort of mobilizing in support of the next generation of startups. And so, you know, if you look at all of the things we do, they fall along a spectrum of three kind of key areas: inspire, start, scale. And so we're looking to provide that inspirational capital that convinces somebody they can do this and they can do this in New Orleans. We are trying to provide the catalyst that helps them start, right? And support them through the opportunity recognition phase, through figuring out what that business is going to look like and getting that product into market. And then where I've spent a lot of my time in the last 3 years in organizations, really building out the scale end of the program, where we're not just getting things started, but we're also helping folks kind of break through that barrier of, you know, hey, I've got something in market. I feel like I have a little bit of traction. Maybe I've raised a little bit of money. I've put a team together around this thing, but I really need the resources to take it to the next level and to get to the first 5, 10, 15 employees to raise $1 million in outside capital. How do we help focus on that and really help increase the pace and the repeatability of the number of those companies that are coming out into our ecosystem?
It's a tremendous impact to the overall region, I think, to Louisiana in general. So it's a great organization. For those people that may be considering different spots, we touched on this slightly, but I kind of almost want to make a pitch. Now, I love New Orleans. I lived here for 10 years, and then I moved away and then came back. So I am a huge fan of New Orleans. I think it's oftentimes undervalued in what it offers. What would you say to those folks that are maybe considering a couple places to start a company? Why should they choose New Orleans?
So I think if you like the underdog story, if you're attracted to that, you're going to like life here. I would say that is something that motivates a lot of people and motivates me, right? As I'm a big Saints fan, and I think when the Saints go in with too high of expectations, it's usually a bad outcome. When we think they're going to lose, they tend to overperform our expectations. That's sort of a good analogy for the city. You know, if you look at New Orleans writ large, we're a place with an incredibly high quality of life, a place with what I like to call enforced work-life balance, as that particularly when things are really rocking in non-COVID times, you know, there are these moments in the year in the calendar of New Orleans where the community just comes together spontaneously and organically in a way that doesn't really happen in Atlanta or Dallas or Houston or even New York. And that's really incredible. And that facilitates this level of connectivity that is really unparalleled. So we joke internally that New Orleans is a 2-degree of separation city. I think that's very true. You get plugged into a couple of folks and they know a couple of folks, and all of a sudden you're talking to the person you need to talk to. And so it's very accessible in that way, but it is also sort of big enough to be a real city, big enough to matter. I actually think our problem set in some ways is an opportunity because we have big city problems. If you can come to New Orleans and solve for crime or solve for education or solve for health, that's going to work in New York. It's going to work in Los Angeles, right? But it's much easier to start that thing here. It's a sort of smaller test bed that you can get into more quickly. It's also a community that really supports its own, right? So there's a sort of fiery passion for supporting New Orleans-based things, which is, you know, really helpful in the early stages. I think for a long time, we got lost in that a little bit and we sort of stopped there. I think that's changed in the last 5 years where people realize that's like a phase, right? And it helps incubate a company or an idea. But you really ultimately need to be focused on selling to the outside world. And we've started to get that right. And that's part of why I think you've seen this sort of gear shift change in momentum over the last couple of years. And it's just a fun place to live. I came here. I'm not from here originally. I grew up in Los Angeles, went to school in North Carolina, was living in North Carolina when Katrina hit. And, you know, saw this as a place where sort of crisis breeds opportunity and a place where you could grow old without growing up, right? And it has proven to be that thing.
I think that's perfect. Grow old without growing up is a great description. It's one of the reasons I love New Orleans. Let's dig into your experience in seeing all these entrepreneurs come through basically your doors, either at Loyola or where you were teaching, or your professor, now Idea Village. I'd love to get into the mindset of the entrepreneurs that have made it or have been most successful. Have you seen anything that you recognize now as these are really some key traits that make people successful or will help them at least become successful in the future?
So I think there is a definite pattern. And I would say that pattern tends to fall into the paradigm of exceptional strength. So one thing that I've seen over the course of my career is there's been this sort of movement from the company we want to support is the company that sort of checks all of the boxes in at least the minimal way to let's focus our resources on the company that really has something or the founder or the idea that really has something that's unique and novel, but may be a total disaster somewhere else, right? That to me is a pattern for startup success. You have to be really obsessed with the thing that makes you unique and the thing that makes you different in order to make the world care and in order to build a business around that. If you surround yourself with the right people, and going back to the core of what we do, you can deal with weaknesses as you grow the business, right? You can create a better management team. You can figure out your finances. You can build a product that does X, Y, and Z. But if you don't have that one key insight that's really unique and really sort of extremely solid, it's tough to build the other pieces. So I like to tell a story that some people get and some people don't, which is from the documentary that Venture for America created following their VFA fellows. These are young people that are basically smart young people coming out of college, taking 2 years to go work in a startup. I may have heard of Teach for America, TFA, sort of that model, but for value creating enterprises started by Andrew Yang before he was a candidate for mayor of New York. And so VFA made this documentary following their fellows through their fellowships. And then they sort of encouraged them to start businesses after the fellowship. So they were following three or four founders that were starting things out of the back end of their fellowship. And one of the founders was the founder of Banza Pasta, the chickpea pasta, red box. You've probably seen it at Whole Foods. And this guy was obsessed with this product, right? Like he was going to make chickpea pasta. And he just had that thing that like his whole life was that thing. And you could tell it from like the first time you saw him on camera in this documentary. And there's this awesome quote at the end of the documentary where Banza has become really successful and has sort of like left all the other companies that were started behind. And they're interviewing the other founders and they say, well, you know, how did you know, what did you see in him that might have said he would be this big success? And the other founder says, well, I knew so-and-so was going to be successful because if there was not a company selling chickpea pasta, this person, this guy who founded this company would be like in his tent, homeless on the side of the road, hawking chickpea pasta everybody went by. So if you're the person who's hawking the chickpea pasta on the side of the road, you're the type of founder I want to talk to.
Excellent. That's a great story. Oh, man. It does touch on the resilience part that I think for folks that know, I work at a startup actually in New Orleans called Ivano, and you get to see it from the inside and you see the ups and downs of startups. And there is a level of, they call it grit, or, you know, it's referred to as grit or resilience, or times in the early stages, people might think you're crazy, but you have to just believe. And I think that just touches on that. So it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the other critical skill that entrepreneurs have to have is the ability to start with a blank sheet of paper and create their own structure, right? So if you're working in a startup, or startup companies get built by teams, we have this sort of cult of the founder, but an early an employee in a startup is really needs to demonstrate this similar skill sets to the founders. You have to be willing to do a lot of different things. You have to be willing to sort of do strategy one day and roll up your sleeves and muck stalls or build product the next day. And you have to be willing to sort of stare down the, what I call the blank piece of paper, the unstructured process, the sort of chaos before there's organization, and be able to deal with that, right? And that's a unique skill set. It's something that as we push into some of these verticals like industrials, figuring out what the adjacent anchors are for that, right? So like, how do you take that project management skill set and apply it to a startup context, right? Those are similar things and much needed in startups, but you have to find the type of people that are comfortable with that chaos, and you have to sort of cultivate them out, right? Because then they can bring order to that process, and all of a sudden the company starts to scale. So I think if you can get those two things, if you can get like crazy obsessed, this vision is going to get executed come hell or high water, and you can get the, I'm going to order the process and put things behind it, and you put those two together, they're one person, great, but probably that's a couple of people, that's a seed of a really impactful company.
Yeah, it's just making me think about the transition I made from basically a large corporation to a startup. And it's incredible to see kind of when you're at the startup level, there is a sense of, you know, chaos is a word to describe it, but I mean, there's so much going on. There's so many hats you have to wear. And if you're in a larger company, typically you have like your boundaries of where you operate in, and you do these things and you have your experts that you can go out to. At a startup, it's much more like, okay, we have this job, we need to do it. And there's not too many people that can do it. And this is something that's a big push right now, that a lot of big companies, like corporations, they want to become more like this. And I know you and I have talked before, you're working with some larger companies, like very large Fortune 500 companies, on helping them get more entrepreneurial. What do you see that some of the larger companies, that the most value-added things that they can pick up from the stuff that you're working on, or the entrepreneurship phases that you guys work with?
Yeah. So I think the first thing to realize is that big companies have an increasing role to play in supporting startups as we move away from the Silicon Valley model of sort of epitomized by companies like Facebook, of this sort of move fast and break things. That works in a consumer sphere, right? Where, you know, if you have a vision for a consumer product and you can iterate really rapidly and you can sort of be obsessed with that consumer vision and you can run really sort of counter to the prevailing narrative, that's often a recipe for success. But that innovation frontier is largely played out. Facebook's a big company. There are a lot of big consumer tech companies. Where the innovation frontier is shifting, you know, the things we talked about earlier, so taking industrials for example, if you're going to innovate in the industrial space, that move fast and break things mantra doesn't translate as well, because if it goes boom, people die, right? And that's a major issue for those companies. And so you have to find a way to plug in that startup ethos, that iterative ethos, into the larger system that is probably still going to be controlled by a large company, right? It's tough to be a startup oil and gas company, for instance, right? It's huge capital expense, lots of safety considerations. The outsider is unlikely to just sort of reinvent that business. They're going to have to work with the insiders to bring that innovation through their channels, right? And so, long way of saying, I think it's really important that big companies are at the table and that they learn how to work with startups and where to plug in that innovation. And so I think for big companies, the thing to realize is they need to create a sandbox where they can try these new ideas, where they can embrace that iterative mindset without sort of killing the innovation on the vine in the sort of procurement, legal, operating test bed sort of environments, right? As you need to have a sort of gated garden or a sandbox in which those companies can play, where you can try new things. And then if they work, you bring them through those processes that are designed to protect you as you scale and as that supporting startup company scales with you. So I think, you know, embracing that model and getting our big companies and the big companies in these spaces where the innovation frontier is going is really critical to the next phase.
Yeah, no, that's so true. It's tough because when you're in a big company, the sandbox is key, because you have so much processes, so many procedures. And it's like, if you think you can do that same thing and go through all those steps, too many roadblocks for somebody very young starting out to try and actually get that off the ground.
What we pitch as an organization is use us as the sandbox, right? So if the big company comes to us and partners with an idea village and says, we're looking for a solution to X, Y, and Z. We're looking for a better way to inspect our pipes, right? Give us, you know, 5 to 10 companies that are working on that problem. We'll put them through a process, through our own accelerator process, where we'll mobilize folks from your organization, from your ranks, to interact with these companies, to mentor these companies, to help them design the right solution for their problem. And then at the end of that, we'll pick 2 or 3 of these and we'll actually put them into pilots. And that pilot will be structured around the program, right? So that creates an inherent sandbox. And then based on the pilots, if we really like it, then we'll take something into sort of full production, right? But if not, they're able to use us as kind of the shield and say, well, that was part of the Idea Village program. We're not adopting that into the mothership. And we've had some success with that model. And it's a model that is used around the country. I think it's getting the companies here to adopt that and the companies in these, you know, increasingly complicated, complex verticals to adopt that model as well.
Yeah. I want to touch on things where you see, you mentioned a couple areas where New Orleans may be picking up or where you see some of the biggest traction, but what area would you be most, are you most excited about that's the potential, the highest potential area you see in the next couple of years for New Orleans?
So I'm super excited about ResTech. So Patrick Comer at Lucid is working to coin a new industry around what Lucid does, which is ResTech stands for research technology. Lucid basically helped bring the market research industry online. So if you think about the traditional mode of market research was predominantly things like surveys and focus groups, right, that were conducted in person. There was a lot of sort of brokering between the different players in that industry up until into the late 2000s, early 2010s, a very analog industry. What Lucid did was create a digital marketplace for survey sample that allows a online property like a Farmville or an online game to say, you know, anywhere that you might volunteer to take a survey to kind of match survey takers with folks that are looking for consumer insights in real time. And out of that, they've created this sort of marketplace for insight, for sort of forward-looking consumer sentiment. So, you know, if you use Google to look at historical information, you might use be able to one day use the Lucid platform to look for sort of future-leaning information. So that's really exciting. And there are a lot of ways that that new data set can be used. And so if we think about creating an industry cluster around ResTech in New Orleans, that to me is really exciting for this city. A particular derivation that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about, which I'll share with you, this is sort of hot off the presses, but and speaks to another industry that I think is a real opportunity for New Orleans. You know, we just had Hurricane Ida. We were evacuated for the better part of 10 days to 2 weeks or stuck without power in the city. While I was personally evacuated, while I was sitting evacuated trying to figure out when I could come back to New Orleans, I spent a lot of time thinking about clean tech. And I was like, you know, New Orleans has been a place for the last 10 years that has talked and thought a lot about how do we export our expertise around resiliency and water management, storm recovery. And that's great, but that's a Band-Aid in the bigger scheme of things here. And so we really need to get to the root of this problem, which is how do we, as a New Orleans community, start to think about exporting solutions to climate change. And that is part the industrial thesis, right? Because I do think the bigger players need to be at the table for that. But if you look at the ways that you think about solving climate change, you have two paths. You have the demand-driven path and the supply-driven path. We have a front row seat in this community to the supply-driven path. And the channels and the people and the partners and the folks that understand that business are here. But we don't talk a lot about the demand-driven side, which is why we don't think of ourselves as doing climate tech or clean tech, because that's what picks up the headlines. But if you add in Lucid and ResTech to that idea, what do you need to understand to figure out what technologies consumers are willing to adopt when is really consumer insight? Right? So there's a whole host of interesting businesses that could be built off of the Lucid platform that look at how are consumers responding to the sort of demand-driven side of solving for climate change. So that's a preliminary idea, but I think it is interesting. And I think, you know, as a community, we're having this sort of wake-up call that we are going to be the canary in the coal mine of climate change. And so who has more motivation to solve that problem than we do?
Yeah, it's such a good point. And we also, I mean, you've got the industry, Louisiana in general, but I mean, we've got so much oil and natural gas, and that's been such a dominant industry in Louisiana for decades. And they're now interested in also diversifying and looking into what the future is. So there's a lot of people asking the same questions. Like, one, the people of New Orleans are experiencing it because it seems like we're getting hurricanes more frequently, or we're getting at least stronger weather. All the right people are starting to ask the right questions. Then it's like, okay, what's next? What's the big thing? So
we are at that moment. And I think I've seen in my own work with the larger oil and gas companies here, they're not oil and gas companies anymore. They're increasingly talking about themselves as energy companies. And they're already shifting their macro language towards getting away from purely being about oil and gas. But they don't necessarily know how to do that. They're going to need partners in all of those technologies. And that's where the startup opportunity comes from, right? As they know they need it, they don't have it internally. It is a shift in their business model. So let's build the startups that can help bring those innovations in.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a question I ask all my guests. Is there something that you've consumed, like content that, you know, it could be video, it could be a book, anything that has really transformed your thinking or has made the biggest impact to your growth?
Yeah. So I've got really two that I think have been sort of very informative of my trajectory. One is Steve Case's book called The Third Wave. So a lot of what we've talked about today is based in that third wave thesis. And the core idea there is that you've had really two waves of innovation and we're about to embark on a third. The first wave, which Steve Case, the founder of AOL, was part of and sort of built his career on, was the infrastructure of the internet and of computing, right? That was the sort of business of getting everybody online, getting a computer in every household, increasing storage to the point that computers were sort of useful, right? And that business required a certain set of skills that really were about dealing with a lot of complexity and sort of technical issues, right? And that required a lot of partnership and a lot of sort of bigger companies working together. The second wave of the internet was the things that got built on top of that, the consumer applications, the big tech companies we talk about today, from Google to Netflix to Facebook to Amazon, right? They leveraged that early infrastructure that was created to build digital products, right? Things that people would consume online. In the second wave, we built this sort of entrepreneurial culture around the move fast and break things idea, right? Where you're sort of pushing a product to market with this sort of relentless speed. And it was sort of an outsider in mantra that really idolized the go it alone path. And then in the third wave, which Case argues we're sort of embarking on now, as like that market has gotten relatively saturated, a bunch of big companies, but where technology is taking us is really back into the offline world. It's Internet of Things. It's more complex industries like health and education and industrials. And when you start to interact with those more complex industries, you actually need a skill set that is closer to what was needed in the first wave than what was built in the second wave, because you're dealing with much more complex problem sets. And so I think we are in the first chapter of that third wave. And I think, you know, what we think about doing as an organization and as a city is kind of writing the playbook for how you implement that third wave, right? And that's something that really excites me.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you mentioned there was another, was there another?
Yeah, so there's a second one, which is basically anything said or written by Steve Blank. So he is the godfather of lean theory and entrepreneurship. And I think the strongest lesson that was learned from the second wave really distilled by Blank. And so we're sort of taking the Blank ideas and trying to figure out how to apply them to the third wave thesis. And that is, you know, hopefully a book that I'll write one day that talks about how to do that in the real world.
I would love to see that book. I think you've got the story and the experience to do it. I think it'd be a great book. With that, I want to thank John for coming on the show. John Atkinson, the CEO of Idea Village. You can reach him at Idea Village, or I mean, look into Idea Village at ideavillage.org. And how can guests or listeners get in touch with you, or how can they follow you on your social? You have that.
The best social for me is LinkedIn. I put out a lot of content on LinkedIn. You can find me under my name, John Atkinson at Idea Village. Also, if you want to keep up with the Idea Village, follow our Twitter handle, as well as you can subscribe to our newsletter on our website, www.ideavillage.org.
Great. All right, everybody. Thank you so much, John, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Omar. Pleasure to be here. Excited about everything you're doing. So thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you'd like to hear more, you can join us at theomarproject.com. That's O-M-A-R. We have a lot more information on project management technical skills, on the leadership, and also you can hear from more of the top experts in the field.